This is an FCIC interview with Skip McGee, formerly of Lehman Brothers. It is August 23rd, 2010 at 2 p.m. I'm Sarah Knaus, also from the FCIC, with Joby Danganon, Chris Seifer, and Troy Burris.
FCIC, we were created by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009. That statute tells us to look at every institution that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of government assistance. It also tells us to look at the issue of systemically important institutions and the issue of too big to fail. Those are a couple of reasons, anyway, why we are investigating and looking at Lehman Brothers and why we thought it would be a good idea to talk to you, Mr. McGee. So as I said, thanks again for taking the time to talk to us. Before we get into the specifics on Lehman, could you just first briefly summarize your educational and work background, starting with college, please?
Sure. How far back do you want to go on education? College level?
Yeah, just start with college, sure.
Okay. Well, I was born and raised in Houston, Texas. Went to public high school there. Then I went to Princeton University, graduated in 1981 with a degree in engineering. Back then it was called basic engineering. Now I think it's called operations, research, financial engineering, the same degree plan. I then went to the University of Texas, enrolled in the joint law JD MBA program. I got impatient and only finished out the law side of it. Graduated with a law degree in 1984. I practiced law with a firm by the name of Andrews & Kurth in Houston, Texas, in corporate securities law for about 2 years. And then I moved to New York City, switched careers, became an investment banker, working for the First Boston Corporation. Was there for a couple of years and then went to Wasserstein Perella, which was a split off from First Boston, an M&A advisory firm founded by Bruce Wasserstein and Joe Perella. Then I moved down and opened a Houston office for them. That was approximately in 90. In 93, I left Wasserstein Perella and opened a Houston office for Lehman Brothers, and then I was with Lehman Brothers from 1993 until the firm failed and I went bankrupt in 2008, so for 15 years.
Okay.
From 93 through 2003, I built up the Houston office and then was very active in our energy practice and then ran the energy group and the power group. And then starting December of 2002 forward, I ran all of investment banking for Lehman Brothers. Since 2008, I've been at Barclays Capital, where I have the role of head of investment banking for Barclays Capital.
Okay, take me through your time at Lehman Brothers from starting with December of 2002 when you ran all of investment banking. Did you always run it out of the Houston office or did you move to New York at some point?
I ran it out of New York. And the job was always a New York job and it was global head of investment banking, so it's been a New York job. Now my family has been in Houston starting in January of 2003 when I started the new responsibilities halfway through the school year, and I quickly figured out that I spent a massive amount of time on airplanes, on the road, away from New York City, and in fact, a lot of time away from the United States. So, but the job was always, the responsibilities were always a New York job.
Okay, and who did you report to when you were heading up investment banking, and did that change from 2002 to 2008?
Yeah, from December of 2002. So, yeah, I would say from 2003 to 2008.
Okay.
The initially, I was running investment banking, but the prior head of investment banking was still at Lehman Brothers, a fellow by the name of Brad Jack, and he was on the executive committee that first year. I was not, and then I was added to the firm's executive committee, and then I reported into the co-COOs of the firm, which were Brad Jack and a guy named Joe Gregory. Then ultimately, Brad Jack moved on, and my reporting line was into Joe Gregory, but kind of also into Dick Bullard.
And did I hear you right? You became a member of the executive committee, I guess, in 2004.
That is correct.
Okay. I want to primarily focus on, if not exclusively focus on, the issues really in 07 and even more so in 08, and what was going on with the firm in terms of efforts to raise capital, efforts to change its funding structure, and discussions with the government about any possible forms of assistance, particularly after Bear Stearns. So if you could... generally, take me through what you are doing at the firm, you know, sort of post-Bear Stearns, generally and specifically in terms of trying to raise capital or any discussions with the government about any potential assistance.
Okay. Well, in terms of raising capital, post March event where Bear Stearns went down and did their transaction with J.P. Morgan, there were a couple of different capital raises by Lehman Brothers, and I was involved in both of those in terms of, you know, our team, the banking team, was involved helping to raise the money, and we became more actively involved as we looked at potential sources of capital for the firm that we needed to make sure that we were coordinated as we looked at potential strategic investors and potential public market alternatives that we were communicating and coordinated, and so our banking began to take a more active role in those, particularly some of the strategic partner type discussions.
Was there any shift in terms of strategy by Lehman in terms of whether it wanted to raise capital pre-Bear Stearns, post-Bear Stearns? There's some allusion to that in the Bankruptcy Examiner's report that you may be aware of.
I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to.
Well, let me help. You know, it's at least in the Veloukas report, there is an indication that pre-Bear Stearns, that Lehman was more interested in trying to shore up its capital or shore up its financial condition by selling assets, for example, and that it did not want to dilute existing shareholders by raising additional capital, but that changed after Bear Stearns. Is that consistent with your recollection or something else?
I don't know that I would articulate exactly those reasons. I would agree that the firm came around to a point of view that we needed to raise some capital, and I think that was pretty clear on the backside of the Bear transaction when the market started to then focus on Lehman Brothers as now the smallest guy on the block. It was clear we needed to bolster capital, and I think we were then looking at what are what are the best ways to do that, recognizing that any capital raise was probably diluted to existing holders, including the employees who owned a significant chunk of the company.
Mm-hmm. We've also seen from other interviews and documents that after Bear Stearns went down in March of 2008, that the SEC and Federal Reserve Bank of New York stepped up its monitoring of Lehman, including having an additional on-site presence. Is that consistent with your recollection?
I don't recall one or the other.
Okay. Did you have any interactions with either folks from the SEC or folks from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York that were on site at Lehman in the March 2008 to September 2008 time frame?
Not to my recollection. I really wasn't anything that was under my purview.
Okay. Did you have any involvement? One of the reasons they were there, apparently, or reportedly, was to monitor the firm's liquidity position and run some stress tests on the firm and apparently cajole, if nothing else, if not more, to get Lehman to shore up its liquidity and funding structure, either by raising liquidity, increasing the maturities of its funding, etc. Do you know anything about that? Were you involved in any discussions in that area?
No, I was not involved in that.
Okay. Hold on one sec. Okay. Were you involved at all in any of the firm's decisions whether or not to use the primary dealer credit facility?
No.
Okay. Do you know if the firm did use the PDCF, if I can shorten it up?
I'm not sure, because I'm not sure exactly which of those... the answer is I don't know. I mean, I don't know when you use that acronym exactly what you're talking about. I mean, the funding stuff was handled by CFO's office and Treasury, and it's really not anything that I got in the middle of.
Right, and that's the Callens, Lewitts, and Tanucci's of the world?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I understand your investment banking and that there's probably a pretty good chance you wouldn't know about this, but I just want to ask to close it out. Okay. In terms, what about we've also seen, throughout the 2008 timeframe, particularly after post Bear Stearns, in addition to trying to just raise capital by issuing shares, the company was in discussions with various entities about an out-and-out acquisition of Lehman. Were you involved in those discussions?
Yes.
Okay. And what can you tell me about that generally? Tell me about who you're talking to, and why none of them occurred.
Well, we probably reached out to almost anybody that could potentially have an interest in either buying all or part of Lehman Brothers. And the problem was, post the Bear transaction, most of the people that would have been natural partners with Lehman Brothers ran either a stake or the entire company, were becoming increasingly busy with their own financial problems. And there never was really a transaction that was actionable.
Did any of the potential acquirers express any concern about certain assets in Lehman's books, and particularly the valuations of those assets?
Well, I think the there was a couple of different things that people were having some concern that the complexity of Lehman's balance sheet, I think, was daunting to everyone, and in particular the breadth and scope of our real estate business was particularly challenging from an evaluation point of view as people looked at those that actually dug in, had some problems getting their arms around that business in particular.
Okay, but understanding that it was challenging and hard to get your arms around Lehman's balance sheet, I take it folks in the industry were ultimately able to get an idea of the type of assets that were on that balance sheet and determine whether or not they thought the valuations were legitimate or not, or whether even if they were legitimate, they just were uncomfortable with those kinds of assets. Were you hearing anything like that from potential acquirers?
Well, in terms of some of the firms that we had discussions with where there was, more than just kind of casual back and forth, and then they said, well, I don't really think so at this point in time, but people that actually did some real due diligence, there were people that had a level of uncertainty as to what the what would be an appropriate valuation for some of these assets, particularly illiquid positions in a very dynamic and changing market environment.
And we know, when we get right towards the end and, folks like Barclays, B of A, and Korean Development Bank decide not to do a deal, of course, we've seen those folks had concerns about types of assets and asset valuation. But before we get to those three entities and that time frame, at the very end, were there any potential acquirers in the March through August time frame expressing similar concerns?
We had a series of discussions with MetLife, and I think one of their issues was getting comfortable with the total real estate exposure and fully understanding it. That's the only other one I can think of. We never got to a position, as I said before, where there was a transaction that I would consider to be actionable.
Mm-hmm. It was mentioned in the Veloukis report that one of the valuation methods at Lehman for determining values of real estate assets was this method called CAP 105, where the company would just take capitalized value of the asset and times it by 1.05. Were you aware of that valuation method at Lehman?
No.
You were not?
No.
Okay, what was your understanding of how Lehman went about valuing the assets, or were you not involved in that?
I was really not involved in the chain of responsibility around preparing our balance sheet and vis-a-vis the various real estate positions. I guess there were some 2,200 real estate positions on the balance sheet, and how that rolled up into a total number that's out on the balance sheet. I wasn't even aware of that.
When potential acquirers, whether it's MetLife or the other three that I mentioned, KDB, B of A, and Barclays, raise questions about asset valuations, did they ask about how Lehman was Lehman's methodology for coming up with those values?
We discussed the nature of the investments, and they, depending on the individual entity you're talking about, they had different degrees of familiarity with the real estate market in the United States, different degrees of familiarity with whether something was a first lien piece of paper or second lien, mezz paper, equity, whatever, the type of real estate asset that it was. And as I said before, I think just the breadth and the complexity of it was daunting even to those that considered themselves to have a fair amount of expertise in the area, and those that didn't, I think, just looked at numbers and said, given the volatility that we're in, you know, the market that we're in, you know, I've got to be conservative here.
Mm-hmm. So I hear you're telling me that, and let's, again, let's focus on the March 2008 through September 2008 time frame. Is it accurate to say that you're involved in efforts to raise capital and find a potential acquirer, whether it's, you know, buying the entire company or a part of the company, but you're not involved in the liquidity and funding part of the business?
That's an accurate statement.
Okay. What else are you doing besides, I'm just trying to get an understanding of what you're doing in this time frame, besides trying to help raise capital and find an acquisition partner?
Well, trying to run the business day to day, basically my day job, and trying to you know, keep our regular clients as clients and keep processing business and you know, hold our bankers together as well.
Okay.
And there were a lot of different work streams that were involved in, you know, when you say raising capital. I mean, we were exploring things that we could do, like spin off the real estate business. We're exploring things. What could we do with the asset management business? Could we sell a piece of it? Could we sell all of it? We looked at other discrete assets that we might be able to sell or monetize, in addition to things that you did at the kind of parent company level, which would be strategic investor, new common, new preferred, different forms of securities. So there are a lot of different work streams that were going on in a parallel path. And as we went through the course of the year, I'd say that those various efforts, you know, began to soak up more of my time. But certainly, you know, I was busy doing what had been my, you know, my day-to-day job all along, which was continuing to try and generate business and bring in revenues to the firm.
Right. When you were looking at the efforts to spin off, I mean, we've seen references to the documents to SpinCo and to efforts to spin off commercial real estate and other types of assets into a separate entity. Can you describe those efforts for us?
Yeah. I think it's a little bit of a, I don't say a natural progression, but when you start to get the feedback from the market that the real estate business is very big, very complex, and very hard to understand, then it was clear that was going to be an issue that we were going to have to deal with in some form or fashion. And then we started to look at, well, what are things that we could potentially do that are in our control, as opposed to getting somebody ultimately comfortable with this big pot of a lot of different kinds of stuff in a backdrop where the market is moving, on a daily basis, and these things are pretty illiquid. The shareholders had that exposure to that asset class today. I mean, I'm putting myself back in that point. They have that today. If we can give them a separate piece of paper that, and let this thing get into a different kind of mode of evaluation, maybe this stuff can season a bit, and, over time, there is some value here, and the shareholders have that today. They've got the upside of that. They've got the downside of that. And if you take that away, that's getting all this focus in what I'll call clean co, away from the real estate, is a much more interesting and compelling story for people. So that's how we kind of evolved to, let's start looking at this spin alternative.
And how was SpinCo, as we've seen it referred to, going to be financed?
Well, that was part of the question was, how do you finance SpinCo? How do you if the entire note is a note from Lehman, have you really separated the risk? And there's lots of different rules that come into play there. Ideally there would be external financing and some combination of external financing and Lehman financing to give this thing some breathing room and let it sit out there. But ultimately there were a lot of issues around SpinCo, some of which were solved, some of which were never completely solved. We also had issues with respect to there weren't the right amount of historical financial statements, and we had to get some potential waivers from the SEC around some things there. There were some issues around some of the accounting, but there was progress being made on the SpinCo front. Then you had to figure out what's the ongoing relationship, service agreements and things like that. Back to parent company, but the thinking was that we probably had to figure out a way to have some external capital in the capital stack, or it undermined some of the separation and other benefits.
What was there any discussion about attempting to provide obtaining financing for SpinCo from the government? Since they had just done Maiden Lane 1 with Bear Stearns, which was effectively a SpinCo?
No, we didn't really look in that direction. I mean, not until
September.
That last weekend.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And again, from what we've seen in various documents, is the type of assets that were contemplated going into SpinCo were commercial real estate and some of the asset backed securities. Is that accurate, or am I missing something?
No, that's accurate. Okay.
So who did you approach in terms of external financing for SpinCo?
Well, we were potentially trying to roll that into a transaction in conjunction with an investment in CleanCo with the Koreans. We were potentially talking to some private equity hedge fund types, and I can't recall exactly who, around playing in a Mez piece of paper at Spinco. But, you know, this was one of those work streams that were going in parallel and ultimately never got into the end zone, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. So, explain to me, let's jump right to Lehman Weekend. Where are you on Lehman Weekend? Are you at the New York Fed? Are you at Lehman's offices? Both? Explain to me your role on that Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Sure. Well, actually, I guess started a little on Thursday with the B of A guys Thursday and then most of Friday, helping to organize and be one of the senior guys involved in that diligence process, which was over at the conference center of Solomon Cromwell. And then the Barclays discussions started on Friday evening, then into Saturday at their conference suite with Simpson Thatcher. So I was involved in the Lehman team that was interfacing with the two potential buyers. There was a separate group of people that ultimately went down to the Fed on Saturday morning, and then on Sunday, and I was never down to the Fed.
Okay, so I'm sorry. So on Thursday, September 11th, 2008, you're working with the B of A folk?
Correct.
Okay. And then you're also working with the Barclays folk on Thursday the 11th, or is that not until Friday the 12th?
They didn't really show up until Friday, my recollection.
Okay. And when I say working with B of A and Barclays, is it accurate to say that that means providing information, helping them with their due diligence?
Correct.
Okay. What... I mean, tell me generally that the kind of information you're providing them, the information they're most interested in.
Well, they were doing we gave presentations on all the different pieces of the business, and then they followed up with the request for additional information, and they had, I don't know how many people in total view they had, but you know, it was probably somewhere between 50 and 100 people, and they had, virtually every room of this conference center in a different group, focused in on some different piece of Lehman. So we were trying to make sure we had the right Lehman people faced off against the right B of A people so that we could get those questions answered, realizing that we needed to get them comfortable that they had all the information that they needed.
Mm-hmm. And so on Thursday the 11th, you're at the Sullivan and Cromwell Conference Center helping B of A doing due diligence, right?
Correct.
Okay, and then on the next day, September 12th, I think I heard you said, were you at Simpson Thatcher's offices and helping the Barclays folks, answering their questions and helping them do due diligence?
Well, I think I was still at the B of A sessions, because I don't think that the Barclays stuff really got cranked up until afternoon evening, and then I went over to the Simpson Thatcher offices and then continued over there on Saturday, and I was kind of shuttling between both places and Lehman's offices. And on Saturday, the follow-up request from B of A really started to dry up, and I became concerned that they were perhaps off in a different direction and speculated that it might even be Merrill, and in fact that's what turned out to be true. Then Sunday, got up and it was actually in a meeting with Jerry Delmessier, who's a senior broadcast person, talking about what we might do you know, going forward around the banking business, and they got the word that the transaction, you know, as contemplated was, you know, was off. So I was, you know, knocked out of bed, getting periodic reports from folks, but I was more involved in interfacing with the two potential buyers.
So are you at Simpson Thatcher's offices on Sunday the 14th also?
Yes.
Okay. Did you obviously you knew there was stuff going on at the New York Fed that weekend, I take it, right?
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, I know you knew that there were other Lehman folks down there. Did you know, for example, that they had this private consortium of other financial institutions looking at, you know, doing a ring fence deal on certain Lehman assets?
Yes, I had heard that.
Okay, and when did you know that? You know, Thursday, Friday when you're dealing with B of A, or not until Saturday, Sunday when you're dealing with Barclays?
It was more Saturday, Sunday, because that was consistent with the Barclays structure.
Okay. When you were talking to B of A, did any of them ever tell you that they were not interested in certain assets?
They didn't say that they were not interested. I think they had a pretty conservative view of value of some assets.
There's I think mentioned in the Veloukis report that I think, I don't know if it was Lewis or Curl or someone else, that essentially said there was $66 billion of assets that they didn't want regardless. Does that jog any memory bells in terms of anyone at B of A saying, even if we're interested in Lehman, we're not interested in that?
Yeah, they never said anything. I never heard anything to that effect from anybody at B of A. They may have said that in a different direction, but I didn't hear.
Okay, and about what point on Saturday at what point on either Friday the 12th or Saturday the 13th does B of A go, as we've heard it termed, radio silent?
Well, I think the well, it clearly was Friday evening. You know, we were expecting, you know, more interaction and perhaps even a, you know, some sort of a rough outline of a proposal, and there was nothing. And then Saturday morning, you know, the all the traffic in the data room had pretty much stopped, so we did not take that as a positive signal.
Right. What was your understanding of why the Barclays deal fell through?
Well, what was relayed to me at the time, and then I guess I've since become more educated on some of that, but at the time was that there was a concern about, you know, basically opening up for business on Monday, and whether Barclays could stand behind Lehman's trading obligations. There was a concern or a rule in the UK that you couldn't step into such a quote unlimited obligation or liability without shareholder approval, that this requirement to get shareholder approval was not something that anybody in the UK was going to waive, and kind of tossed the ball back to this side of the Atlantic, and there was not a desire to do anything, so that the decision was made that there was not a transaction that could be done or approved, and therefore Lehman Brothers had to go bob.
And where did you hear that information from?
I first heard of the fact that the transaction had not been approved
I received a phone call. I was in the middle of a meeting with Jared Del Messier. My cell phone rang. It was Mark Schaefer, who was part of the group down at the Fed. And he was our M&A, our head of M&A, and was involved in the transaction. He said the deal's off, that the FSA won't approve it. I then mentioned that to Jared Del Messier, who had not heard anything, and so he excused himself to go out of the room and find out if in fact that was true. And he came back with a bad look on his face and said, yeah, that is accurate. So I didn't know what else to do, so I left and went back to Lehman Brothers, and we didn't have any other plays in the playbook at that point, and it was pretty unhappy time.
Right. So what efforts were, I mean, of course, we know ultimately the firm does file for bankruptcy early Monday morning, but what efforts were there, to your knowledge, to avoid that result once you learned that the Barclays deal was not going to occur?
Well, we were, we really didn't have a, a whole lot of plays left to run. We tried to figure, is there anybody else that we could possibly reach out to that we haven't spoken with? And the fact of the matter is that there's nobody that, given where the financial markets were, given the complexity of the situation, was going to be able to move in the time frame that we had in front of us. It became clear that we were going to have to file, and there was a holiday in Tokyo, so we didn't have to put the Asian business in first. We actually had to go in first in the European business, and then I guess the holding company in the U.S. went in. But there wasn't a tremendous amount of additional stuff to get done. I had a communication with all my directs, and had the very sad chore of basically telling all these people that we had run out of alternatives, and that absent some last minute miracle, we were filing that night, and people were distraught, upset. It was not a great moment.
No, I'm sure. We've heard from talking to other folks that there were at least some discussions with the government about assistance and about what the repercussions of a Lehman bankruptcy would be. Were you involved in any of those discussions, or are you aware of any of those discussions?
Was not involved in any of those discussions. I heard about them after the fact, that was, I guess, part of the team that was down there at the Fed, I think, saying, this could have some negative impacts. But I was not involved in those discussions.
And understanding you weren't involved, what did you hear, if anything, about what was said and what the government's response was? And obviously the government's response ultimately was no, but what did you hear about why the government was saying no assistance, if anything?
What I heard was that the government said, we're not in the
in the business of providing assistance to financial institutions.
Were you aware about whether or not Lehman put together any kind of a presentation that you know, set forth what they thought the consequences of a Lehman bankruptcy would be? Sort of, you know, lay out, here are the various systemic consequences, given the knowledge that the government does have powers to provide assistance in such cases like they had done in the Bear Stearns deal back in March, and like they had done a week earlier by putting the GSEs into conservatorship?
I had heard that there were some materials that were put together. I never saw them, but I had heard that after the fact. At the time, I was not aware. I do know that people stressed the importance and the job losses, et cetera. But I heard after the fact that some things were pulled together, but I never saw that.
And other than hearing that the government said we're not in the business of providing financial assistance to financial institutions, any more color or specifics on what folks were telling you about the government's response?
Nothing. Emotions were high. I think people didn't exactly feel warmly embraced, but that anything I would repeat would be just a lot of editorial comment that probably wouldn't surprise you anyway.
Right. Have you had any discussions, since the bankruptcy, with anybody from the government about the decision not to provide government assistance?
No, I was interviewed by the senior, but I've reflected the same things that I've told you to him, nobody from the government has talked to me.
Hold on one sec.
Hi, I'm Tom Stanton. I'm, interested in questions of governance, and in particular, how Lehman made risk-return trade-offs. And I'd like to go back, if we could, to happier times when you joined the executive committee in 2004. When you were on the executive committee, was the chief risk officer also a member of the executive committee?
The chief risk officer at that point in time, I guess, was probably not an official member of the executive committee.
Can you describe the executive committee, and particularly the relationship to the CEO, and the extent to which you felt there was full and open conversation about issues relating to risk and return?
I'm trying to be responsive. Let's see, so back to 04, 05, the executive committee where risk and return discussions would come up would be in the context of approval or non-approval of specific transactions that were of the size to come to the executive committee.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those discussions were open and and honest and discuss the merits of the transaction vis-a-vis the balance sheet commitment.
Sort of allocation of capital, that kind of question.
Yeah.
And you're
more around a specific transaction as opposed to, generally.
Does that mean, would the executive committee discuss limits? Sort of how much we are ready to expose ourselves in a certain line of business?
I can recall from time to time discussions of limits more in the context of CFO and others have been looking at this and want to recommend an adjustment to this limit or that limit based on something that's changed in the business environment or changed in terms of our balance sheet or otherwise, but there wasn't a lot of discussion that I can recall about the limit on this should be X, Y, or Z.
The Veloukis report talks about a number of times that limits were raised, and I'm curious how those conversations would take place, and for you, it would be within the Global Investment Banking Unit. Would it be the CFO that would talk to you or the Chief Risk Officer that would talk to you to have a conversation about whether, and I assume you would have thought the limit should be raised and they might have thought it should be lowered. Is that the way the conversation would take place?
So let me first... So when you say that limits were raised, you mean increased?
Yeah.
As opposed to raised as a topic?
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. Okay. I think as the firm was in a growth mode and was expanding both its geographic scope as well as its market penetration. And I think the ability to move risk as opposed to store risk was perceived to be improving, and that was a basis for some of those. But again, when they came up, they were, there's a recommendation to do this for these reasons, I wasn't pushing back. I was a beneficiary of that, that it could potentially fund more transactions, but I didn't push back on that stuff, but it was floated. But I can't remember specific instances and specific numbers at all. That was a long time ago.
Well, we're talking, I guess, 04, 05, is that roughly the time period? Maybe 06?
Well, I think the firm was growing pretty significantly in the 04, 05, 06 time frame.
Right.
And the markets were pretty constructive as well.
Right.
And I can't remember specific instances when the limits were raised, and I can't remember if they were presented by the CFO or the head of risk. But those are the two main constituents in terms of, I think, articulating that. But I really can't recall who specifically led the discussion or the specifics of the discussions.
Well, in terms of process, as you said, you were the beneficiary if a limit was increased, but it didn't sound like you were the one saying the limit should be increased. Where was that coming from?
I think, I'm not sure exactly, other than if we felt like things were... You kept kicking up against the limit and you kept looking at it and saying, okay, we'll let this thing go through, and then as a matter of housekeeping, you would adjust, you know, what the limits were for either transactions to get approved at a certain level or whatever. Whether that came from the risk committee or the CFO's office, you know, I don't know.
So they would basically, someone would go to them and say, gee, we're kicking up against these limits, we need to increase them, and then it would be the CFO's office or the risk committee that would raise this issue to the executive committee. Do I have that right?
I'm speculating because I don't know exactly what conversations took place away from you know, my participation, you know, around this topic, but I'm speculating.
Well, what was?
I'm trying to be helpful, but I don't know.
Well, assume the scenario you're talking about, kicking up against the limits multiple times. What was your role in raising that question?
The only time that I can be that I can recall having been involved in a discussion around balance sheet or risk vis-a-vis limitations was in the context of kind of the 06 maybe into call it 05, 06, 07, and you'll hit the time sometime in there where we were not very prevalent at all in the LBO business, and we're being leaned on pretty hard by the CEO to explain, you know, where we were in terms of that market. And I said, well, if we're gonna do that, then we've got to be willing to put a little more capital to work in some of these transactions. And we did somewhere in that time frame become a bit more aggressive in our participation in some of the LBO transactions.
So if I understand right, the CEO said, hey, you know, we need to get more involved in the LBO business. You said if we're going to do that, the limits need to be increased. Did that go to the executive committee, or was that essentially a decision that the CEO would make with your input?
I think it was discussed at the executive committee. But we were in a not even, well, barely a top 10 position in terms of participation in the LBO market, and there was a desire to move that up, and we had to consciously put a little more balance sheet to work to do that.
And was that, would you say, in the end, it was the CEO's decision rather than a committee decision?
Well, in any organization, I'd say, it, particularly an organization with a strong CEO,
yeah.
You know, I think those kind of become one and the same. It wouldn't have happened if the CEO wasn't supportive. I think that, you know, a committee did discussion.
Okay. And when you say the ability to move risk versus store risk was improving, what kind of examples do you have that are relevant here?
Well, that I can't give you specific. That's probably repeating something that I've heard before. But if when the markets were in the 04, 05, 06 time frame, transactions were working and underwrites were clearing and So it's kind of a generic comment. I can't give you, you know, specifically I'm pointing to this or to that.
Did you ever have discussions with the chief risk officer about questions of limits in various areas?
No.
So you really related to the CFO and somebody at that level rather than to the chief risk officer in any way?
I was much more involved in individual transactions. And an individual transaction would come up, did it make sense or not make sense? And what were the pros and cons? Now, if an individual transaction put us in a situation where we were pushing up next to a limit, then the limit would factor into the discussion. But I didn't, other than the one time around LBOs that I mentioned, I didn't run around talking about our risk limits. Yes, it's not part of what I do.
So let's go to individual transactions. Did you relate to the chief risk officer in discussing the pros and cons of those?
If there was a risk meeting where one of these transactions was to be discussed, sometimes I would be there, sometimes other senior members of investment banking would be there to discuss the particular transaction.
What was your impression of the quality of the presentation of the chief risk officer in those meetings where you did attend to discuss a particular transaction?
I don't know how to respond. I mean, against what standard or what?
Were they raising reasonable issues to your mind?
I think they were raising reasonable issues? Yeah, I think they raised reasonable issues.
Thank you.
And Mr. McGee, I just have a few more questions. When you were looking for a potential partner or acquirer in the summer of 2008, was the federal government involved at all? Anybody from Treasury or the New York Fed?
No.
How about J.P. Morgan? Was J.P. Morgan involved in the process of finding an acquirer?
No.
And did you interact with regulators at all in the summer of 2008 through the fall?
I did not. I should caveat that to say, you know, from time to time, there might have been a phone call or a discussion where Dick Bolt was on the phone with somebody and I would wander into the room or, you know, be in the room, but that was a very small percentage of those types of phone calls.
Were you involved in the idea of go ahead.
Yeah, and I never said anything in any of those calls.
Were you involved in the idea of making Lehman a bank holding company?
I was aware of that effort. That was primarily driven by the legal department.
Mm-hmm. And what happened to that proposal? Well, what's your understanding?
It was turned down.
Do you know why?
I'm not sure I have a great articulation of the reason why.
And do you know who turned it down? Was it the Fed or FDIC or?
I don't know specifically who turned it down.
Okay. Now, the week coming to the bankruptcy, were you aware about the collateral dispute with J.P. Morgan?
I had heard about after the fact, after we had posted some significant additional collateral, you know, I had heard about it. Yes, so I was aware of it. I was not aware of it contemporaneously with it occurring.
So I take it you weren't in any of those meetings or calls with J.P. Morgan regarding the collateral requirements?
That's accurate.
Okay.
Yeah, that's correct.
Now, the Sunday of the Lehman weekend, were you surprised that Lehman was allowed to fail? That is, coming to that weekend, did you believe that Lehman was too big to fail?
I guess I would say it this way. Going into the weekend with B of A having 50 to 100 people on site and Barclays actively engaged and the government presumably, you know, fully believed that there would, you know, I thought that there would be some sort of a transaction that would come out of the weekend. I didn't have the words "too big to fail" in the back of my head as, you know, as we went into the weekend.
But you were still surprised that Sunday.
What's that?
Let me rephrase that. So that Sunday afternoon, do you recall any talks about an expanded PDCF? When we talked to your former colleagues, they thought that if they had access to that expanded PDCF, Lehman would have been able to open the following day.
And when you say what the acronym stands for?
Primary Credit Dealer Facility.
Dealer Credit Facility.
Yep.
So the enhanced and unlimited access to the window, more or less.
Yep.
I think there were a couple of things that, you know, occurred shortly after that could potentially have been beneficial, but it's impossible to say whether they would have been dispositive or not, and I guess that's one of them, and this whole bank holding company thing that was turned down for Lehman was approved in some other directions, but I can't tell 2020 hindsight whether that was, or just, you know, speculation as to whether that would have what that would have done.
Okay. And my last question is, why do you think Lehman failed? I just wanted to get your personal views.
Well, I think that there was, you know, an old-fashioned, you know, run on the institution in a manner of speaking, and there was never, the internal team, we could never get in front of it with a solution that could fully take care of the situation. We raised a little bit of capital along the way, you know, ended up not being enough. We couldn't, you know, the entire market was moving in a direction that made it very, very hard to get somebody to partner up with us, and ultimately we just could never get in front of the problem. And I think it's very saddening still to talk about all this. It kind of brings up I'm happy to visit with you guys. It does bring up some not so happy memories. It's painful to think about that, and the fact that an organization that a lot of people care a lot about, and the employees were very loyal, and they had spent their entire career there. It was sad to see it go down.
Mr. McGee, when's the first time you heard that Lehman actually had concerns about being able to fund its business?
Really not until the final weekend.
I mean, there were always concerns about liquidity and the cushion, but that's when I started to hear about the fact that the available cushion that had been out there, that had always been there, that had been in large part, I think, a lot of the spare collateral that was around had been put over to J.P. Morgan.
Mr. McGee, thank you very much for your time. I'll tell you what I tell everybody we interview when we get finished. We'll talk amongst ourselves, look at our notes, and if we realize we forgot to ask you something and need to follow up, we'll call your counsel. I doubt that'll be necessary. So thank you for your time, and counsel, thank you for your time also.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so long.
Thank you.